Okay, well, thanks for hanging around. As you can see, we're going to talk about water and nitrogen requirements for developing pomegranate. And I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Weiwei Zhang and Dong Huang. Let's see how this works. So, okay, in California, pomegranate's actually a minor crop. It's only about 12,000 hectares. It's really native to India, Iran, Turkey, and that part of the world. And the major producing countries are Iran, India. India has some 108,000 hectares of pomegranate. So California is kind of a minor player. The part of the reason that was we did this project is that really pomegranates have been around a long time. It's mentioned in the Bible. It's a couple thousand years old, but a lot of people don't know what the actual crop water requirements are and the nitrogen requirements are. It's thought to be salt tolerant. It's thought to be drought tolerant. But really what's driven it is that wonderful orchards, Palm Wonderful, if you're out there buying something in the hour-shaped glasses, really have emphasized sort of the healthy bioactive compounds that are in pomegranate juice. And so that's really driven what has happened in California as well. So what we wanted to do is to take a look at the seasonal water requirements of pomegranates, and then just take a look at the nitrogen requirements of a mature pomegranate. And if you look at the literature, there's a lot of information out there. It depends on where you are. The project, we had actually two projects that I'll talk about. The first one was at the Kearney Agricultural Center. The other one was at our site on the San Joaquin Valley Agricultural Sciences Center. Most of the weather data that we have is from a SIMA station that's located on the Kearney Center. And the crop, you know, it was a two-part sort of thing. Is the first part of the project was from like 2010 to 2013 was just growing the crop. I mean, see, one of the problems you have with perennial crops is you first have to grow it before you can do anything with it. So that was what we did for the first 3 years. And then the next 3 years, then we tried to take some data from it. This is the layout of the project at the Kearney site. You can see it's a randomized complete block design, and we have six treatments basically. We have surface drip, subsurface drip, and three levels of nitrogen. Now, how do you know what levels of nitrogen you have if you don't know what it is? So we said 50, 100, 150%. And the 50% was really the lowest amount that we could put on to keep the plants alive and going, and then after we kind of built it up from there. Basically, each of the plots then had at least three rows in it. The middle row was then used for the experimental purposes, and there were five trees in there that were used then for the experimental purposes. And the important part of this then, this was driven by a lysimeter. Okay, there's a weighing lysimeter out there, and I'll show you that in a minute. That lysimeter then really determined and drove everything that was happening. And just to see how complicated you can make it, I can show you what the headworks looked like in terms of having six different places where you had two different irrigation systems and three levels of fertilization. And this is some of the electrical components associated with it. And I will say that I had nothing to do with this. Actually, Claude Finet, who is the co-PI on this, this was his bag. He likes this stuff, and he's fairly good at it. So he really was the person that designed this and kind of put all this stuff together. So I'll give him full credit for the success of this particular project. Okay, just to let you see what it's all about then, this is the Kearney weighing lysimeter. This is a set of lysimeter. It's been there for about 30-plus years and been used for several crops along the way. As you can see, it's 2 meters wide, 4 meters long, and 2 meters deep. That's fairly good resolution. On the left-hand side, then, an early pomegranate tree. On the right-hand side, one that's been growing for a while. The important part here that I want to point out that this is a multi-trunk thing. Pomegranates are basically a bush. And so that's what, in this particular project, we let them do, is grow like a bush. This is then looking at the side of it, and we had some soil matrix potential sensors installed at the depth, as you can see in the lysimeter. There were two sets of sensors that we used then to average to get some data to take a look at the matrix potential and potential gradients within the soil as we went. how we installed it. It's fairly typical installation. Then you can see it was shanked in, the rolls there, the drip tubing had 2 liter per hour emitters on about a meter spacing, about 0.6 meter depth, 1.8 meter spacing, and obviously the tree row would be halfway between those two. As you can see below that, then the other treatment then was surface irrigation, and we had these surface lines put, laterals put in the same relative position to the plant row itself. So, on the surface irrigated plots, that's the way it worked. So, show you a little results then. This then for 2015, the three things you can see there are the potential evapotranspiration, and that came out of the Kearney site, the Sima station, the ETC, this was measured by the weighing lysimeter, and then the crop coefficient was generated as the ratio of the ETC to the ETO. And there's a couple of things that are going on there, I think you'll see. Is one is that the peak ETO occurred roughly in May, June. The peak crop water use happens in July. And when you look at the calculated value for the crop coefficient, it comes out quite a bit later in the season. So it's a kind of different in that regard. One of the things that I want to point out is Claude is a real fan of high-frequency irrigation. Okay, so we saw some earlier work in other places, but when I say high-frequency, he was measuring crop water use, and we irrigated every millimeter of crop water loss. So sometimes later in the season, you would have anywhere up to 8 irrigations per day. So, I mean, and basically what is reflected here on the left-hand side is then what is the mean soil moisture potential at those various levels. And you can see it's fairly constant through the season with the exception of that one blip. And that blip was a result of a malfunction of the irrigation system, and it continued to run a little longer than it should have. And so, you know, it was fairly responsive, and so it was kind of watered up. But the one of the things that Claude has talked about over the years is that, well, if you have a high-frequency irrigation, you're minimizing stress, and there should be some responses to that. And then the next part of it is on the right-hand side. Then we took those data and calculated what the hydraulic gradients were between those various steps. And you can see the blue going up means the water is moving up in that zone, and the red going down is the water is going down in that zone. Well, as it turns out, the red zone there is actually between the other two. So effectively, what you have is you have distribution of water then within that the crop root zone, but you don't have any water moving below the crop root zone. So, and I should have said that this was done in the lysimeter, which was a subsurface drip irrigated system, and it had 80 meters in there as well that are comparable to what you had in the field. So. The takeaway message here, we think, is that with this kind of management, you have a potential to really reduce the deep percolation losses. And nitrogen losses to groundwater is a fairly big issue in California. Okay, so what about the water balance then? I've given you the entire water balance starting from when these were planted early on through 2015 when the plants are actually removed from the field. And you can see the potential evapotranspiration remains fairly constant. You know, it's fairly hot in Fresno in that part of the Central Valley, so we don't expect a lot of changes. Precipitation, well, we just had a drought. It wasn't the early part of it. You know, there was a lot of water later on, 2013 on, a lot less water because of the drought. And then the DI was the surface drip irrigation, and SDI was subsurface drip irrigation. And I should have mentioned earlier that there is a difference between the two, and the difference is a result of a conscious effort to apply 10% more water to the surface drip than the subsurface drip. And later on, you'll see exactly why we did that. You know, ostensibly is to account for any surface evaporation and loss through weeds. So those are the two And the bottom line then, as you would expect, over time, the plants matured, ETC developed, and we feel like in the range of about 950 millimeters seems to be what the total crop water requirement would be for a multi-trunked system. So that's a little bit of what it looks like as they got a lot older. You can see then the fruit there, all the fruit were harvested from a single tree, and weighed separately, numbers counted, so you went through and you could come in with an average weight of their fruit, and they were also characterized as being prime and subprime, or prime would have no blemishes, might have surface scarring, and then eventually something about whether they were green or broken open, that sort of thing. There were several categories, but anyway, this is probably like 2014. So you can see they're fairly robust, fairly large trees. I would make one other comment. You can see those seem to be fairly large fruit. Now, I was at the store the other day there in Fresno, and we had fruit that were about half the size of that, and they were trying to sell them for $2 a piece. So, that probably is a pretty good value if you could find a place to sell it. And I had recently been in the Middle East, Uzbekistan, and they weren't nearly as nice as that as well. So, anyway, then to get a look at the total yields from this system, so we have two ways of looking at it. The first then was just averaged the yields across by surface or subsurface drip irrigation, and you can see the categories that I talked about, the prime, subprime, and the totals. And then on the right hand side then we averaged within the by irrigation system, then looked at the irrigation, the nitrogen levels. And the takeaway message then was, when you looked at, say, the prime and subprime in 2013, and maybe down in 2015, there were differences between the irrigation systems themselves, but when you summed them, there really were no statistical differences in the total yield across these systems, so the irrigation systems themselves. And you see the similar sorts of results when you looked at the nitrogen level. So really the nitrogen was not affecting what the total yields were. I keep blaming Claude, but Claude would always point out that the subsurface drip had slightly higher yields than the surface drip. That was, he had to be sure to point that out. Well, I won't talk a lot, but Weiwei did a lot of this work, and he was measuring the canopy size, and you can see the gadget she had. I think it was a Tetracam that she had used there to take a look at the characterizing the crop sizes. Here, she was looking then at some differences between surface and subsurface drip, the canopy sizes, then on some work that was talking about on the Kearney site. This isn't my area, but one of the things she wanted to look at to see if there was a good way to characterize the fractional canopy size. And then another comment that they had is, again, the subsurface drip was a little bit bigger than the surface drip. But some of the work that Weiwei did was then to take a look at characterizing the crop coefficient as a function of the fractional canopy size. And so you can see this, I mean, she's published that work in Irrigation Science, so you can get sort of more detail on it than I can provide. But there were differences between what she was seeing on the Kearney site and what we were seeing at our site. And part of that is due to the difference in characteristics of the plants themselves, because the Kearney site was a multi-trunk system, kind of a bush. What we had on our site was then a plant that had been made into a tree, as you will. So there were just four main scaffolds that were associated with it. The canopy was a lot smaller, a lot more pruned than what you had here. And this is what I was talking about a little earlier in terms of the 10%. So on the right-hand side, you can see what the weeds were like on subsurface drip, and on the left-hand side, the surface drip. And this is pretty typical throughout each of the year that we did it. And then the site that we looked at, the site on our the San Joaquin Valley site, is And that's a misnomer when I say the T1 is 35% of ETC. It's there's four levels of crop water use that we looked at, and I don't, the ETC might not be full ETC, but this then gives you an idea of what the layout looked like as far as there our site was there. Headworks weren't nearly as complicated. We just had four irrigation systems that we had to work about. The difference here is that we had just a single line of drip emitters then on each of the rows, and then there was emitter on each about half a meter off of each plant, and then one in the middle. And so, to some extent, we were limited in terms of the amount of water we could put on in a single irrigation without flooding the site. We didn't have a high frequency irrigation. We irrigated about every 4 millimeters of measured ET. And also take a look here, as you can see the difference in what the structure of the plants were here that was brought up, and you have a single trunk coming up and it's divided from there. And this is our lysimeter. Again, it was a 2 meter by 4 meter, but we had 3 meters deep, and then we had two plants actually that were driving the system. So we took a look at the yields and the number of fruit tree, and I think you can very quickly see some differences there. The number of fruit per tree on our system was significantly lower than what you saw at the Kearney site, and which means that the total weights would also be per tree would be quite a bit different. But the one thing I thought was interesting to point out was that the actual fruit weight themselves were quite similar across the treatments either site. So, you know, they about 400 grams, and it's similar regardless of the system that you were looking at. So we took a look then at the applied water per tree, and we characterized it. When I started to think about it, one of the problems we had was that we start talking about millimeters of applied water, and then there was actually two separate sets of tree densities, plant densities between the two sites, and I thought it was simpler then to take a look at the applied water per tree. And as you would expect then, our T4 treatment, which was the highest level, was significantly lower than what we saw at the Kearney site. But this was, I found, was kind of surprising, because then I took a look at the yield data themselves and then took a look at the applied water per tree. And when I plotted it, we came up with this particular relationship. And so we'll have to do some more thinking about it. But it seemed to me that it's probably not unrealistic that really what's happening is by the trees themselves are adapting in terms of the water stress that's being evolved. So they limit the number of fruit that are there, but still maintain their fruit size. And of course, there's differences in the number of available fruiting sites between the two sites, one being heavily pruned and not being pruned. So you end up getting these kinds of relationships that would also reflect the total applied water as well as the total yield. So I've mentioned Claude a lot, and so there he is in the front with the cap on. One of the other contributors is Don Makis. He's way in the back there. And then Becky Finney here is on the right, and she was pretty instrumental in keeping the project going. So we came up with, we felt like, when I say 62 kilograms per hectare, and really I think realistically it's better to take a look at the number of grams per tree. And so in the order of 109, if you wanted to use the 62, but 109 to 110 probably, or 20 grams per tree is probably a reasonable value for nitrogen sustained production. Again, the high frequency irrigation we felt like does a good job of controlling nitrate leaching. One of the advantages of subsurface drip, you're putting materials right there where the roots are. We felt like the full water requirement was the order of 950 millimeters for a multi-stem plant. And I guess you could say that pomegranate really is a drought-tolerant plant. It can produce over a wide range of applied water. We're looking at this, I don't know if I did my math right, about 15% of water requirement, but still, you know, if you look at liters of applied water per tree, there's a wide range, and you still maintain productivity. So people who are interested in growing these things or in your backyard or something, there's a real potential for being able to grow the crop. And I better acknowledge the California Department of Food and Agriculture, the Fertilizer Research and Education Program, for funding it. It is now Wonderful Orchards, not Paramount Farming, who provided the trees. Lakos, the filter set, Taro, some tubing, some of the other people, and certainly all the support staff that we had that provided help in doing this. So there we are. Thank you.
Nitrate application, but maybe I missed it. Was it a constant fertigation under, I'm going to say, low fertigation, or was it specific fertilizer events?
Specific fertilizer events. They did it initially, figured out what the total was going to be, and applied it at the beginning of an irrigation. So it wasn't, there was continuous application of phosphorus.
Okay.
Because they worried about phosphorus deficiencies, but the other part of it, you had to do a lot to balance the pH in the water as well, because I didn't talk about that, but it's hard water, and so you try to keep the pH below 6, and so phosphorus was injected routinely until I did that. And there was some potassium that was put on about a weekly basis, but the Claude calculated what he wanted, and he got that pretty much fairly early in the growing season. It kind of tapered off. So the initial fertilization was done early in the growing season, and it tapered off towards the end of the season. Yes?
Is drip irrigation the common method to irrigate pomegranate in California or Iran, or is it kind of dependent?
Kind of depends on where you are. Wonderful Orchards does use drip irrigation, yes. I suspect a lot of the other places, Israel, I assume, uses drip irrigation. But when you get into the other parts of the world, it's pretty much going to be furrow irrigation as opposed to drip irrigation. Yeah. So.
Any other questions? With that, let's give a round of applause for all the speakers.